This edition of the Packet Pushers podcast is brought to you by Infinetta Systems, a leading innovator and provider of hyperscale WAN optimization solutions. Infinetta's WAN optimization product, the Data Mobility Switch, allows enterprises to expand and fill large WAN links. Companies benefit from increased WAN utilization, improved application performance, and cost savings from fewer bandwidth upgrades. Infinetta helps you move more data more quickly using less bandwidth. Get more information at www.infinetta.com.
This week's show is also sponsored by GetConsole, makers of the finest iPad terminal app for networking engineers. If you need a rock-solid, feature-rich terminal app to run on your iPad, including serial console support, check out www.getconsole.co.uk. Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people, network engineers even, discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. This week, we're having a show which is the Virtual Whiteboard Reincorporated. After a bit of a break where we've been wandering around the world like sad chooks with heads cut off, we've returned to our favourite virtual scenario in the virtual boardroom with the virtual whiteboard and a cast of virtual heads to tell us, talk to us and make us smile about network engineering. You wouldn't believe it, would you? But before we get going, remember that we love to hear your feedback and get your input about today's show and to tell us things that you'd like to discuss. So send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you are thinking. Alternatively, check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net, leave comments, and don't forget to throw us a bit of a donation. We like coffee. We like free coffee even more. So the odd donation to be nice to us and show your appreciation for the show goes a long way to making us smile. To go around the virtual workbench today, first of all, welcoming Mr. Ethan Banks. How are you, sir?
Hey, Greg, it is Thanksgiving here in the U.S., and I'm getting ready for a day of good food and family and just enjoying the company of some folks. So that's where it's at, man. Technically, I'm glad to have a day off from packets, except for this show, of course.
And also with us today is Ivan the Pepelniak. How are you, Mr. P?
Thank you. Discovering the dark side. Like Junos wouldn't be enough, I decided to get a Mac.
So I'm totally gone over. Join the herd. Join the rest of us. OS X, the best and most reliable platform to run Windows, in my opinion.
I'm not there yet.
And also with us this week is Amy Arnold. Amy, welcome to the show again.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yes. After you're passing your MPLS exam, your CCIP something or another, is that right?
I am working toward it. I've done a half of the required test, so two more to go. Little BGP, little routing.
Yeah.
No big deal.
There's a little chauvinist part of my brain here going, what?
Girls don't do networking. Yes, we do.
Networking, but with MPLS, there's a little part of my brain going, that's not possible. That's a men thing. But that's just me being a recidivist, I guess.
You'll have to work on that.
Okay, and I'm sure that Mrs. Y is frothing at the mouth because she's about to tell me that I'm an idiot. Is that right?
I'm just so flabbergasted. She's gotten that far with it. I mean, she's doing great. I'm really in awe. And I've built a small shrine to her in my in my apartment. So
nice. Very nice.
Namaste. And with us today is Bob Plankers, all the way from the server administration world, that is the lone sysadmin. When he's not being lonely, he is Bob Plankers.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me on. Just enjoying Thanksgiving, talking to you guys, giving thanks for the networks that keep all of our stuff connected. So.
Yeah. And we thank you for generating packets at the same time.
Oh, I'll generate a lot of them.
Yep. And if I may add, I would like all the sysadmins to be like Bob. Then our life would be so easy.
Well, thank you.
Yes, our life would be vastly improved if we had some intelligence right across the entire industry, to be fair. And last but not least is Tom Hollingsworth. How are you, Tom?
I'm pretty good. I'm going to spend an afternoon dodging technical questions from relatives, and hopefully I can hide behind some rocks so they won't ask me how to update their smartphone.
Well, now that iPhone's got smart updates over the air, your workload should reduce, I guess.
The updates on the iPhone are smart. The people updating it aren't.
Yeah, it still doesn't mean that they're going to do it.
Exactly.
Tom, you have to break one thing really badly. Then it will all stop.
I'll take that advice under advisement.
And he takes breaking a few things on a permanent basis and they stop asking you any more questions. That's a good point, Ivan. That's full house today, I think. Have I missed anybody? That would be a no. Okay, so today is a virtual whiteboard show where we just want to talk about, well, stuff, I guess. And there's no particular topics. There's no particular theme. We felt that just talking about various stuff, I guess we could kick off with a security topic of the SCADA hacking, which was very popular this week, where somebody in the there was a supposedly a hacker who hacked into a SCADA system, and then the water pumps that he was hacked into on the security on the SCADA network then blew up, and it's now being called critical infrastructure hacking.
Well, except DHS is denying the whole thing.
Yes.
Department of Homeland Security saying nope, we're not sure, we don't think so, but then. Then some hacker responded with compromising something in South Houston, Texas.
Yeah. And then I saw an article the other day which said it was actually the default three-letter password that Siemens sets when it ships.
Right, right. And they're built-in passwords as well. I mean, it's like, and I don't know if anybody knows this, but SAP has the same thing, internal default passwords that aren't easily changed. And but apparently, the SCADA systems are worse because they're, you know, three letters. And then somebody posted, I then posted passwords you shouldn't use, but somebody should send that to Siemens.
Well, and then the other side of things, the people that are working on them just write the password on the side of the controller down in the guts of a building somewhere. All you have to do is get a key, walk in there, and you have the password.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, these aren't, I mean, and, you know, the discussion has come up, who do you blame? I mean, do you blame the manufacturing companies? I mean, that's where I side. Or do you blame the users? I mean, but these users are they've been doing things a certain way for a long time. They don't really come from IT. And I think the onus is really a lot on the vendors to step up to the plate and start, you know, they're putting this stuff on the public internet or on the wire, and they need to do something to save us from ourselves. And when I say us, I mean in that industry, in the service and control industries.
Yeah. Well, if I understand the problem, and I was just reading some security advisories when this whole thing first started to erupt, you can't change the default passwords.
Right.
Because there are so many things that do, like, you know, not exactly remote procedure calls, but like expect scripts between different modules.
Yeah, they're
and all those passwords are hard coded, so you change it, everything breaks apart.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, I mean, that's so 10 years ago.
Well, it's even worse. The SCADA people that I've worked at in two or three different places, they find running Windows on a computer a real challenge. They have no idea how SCADA works and what it does actually inside. All they know is that if they do this, then it does that, and that's what they do. There's very little. Down at the user end, like the people who actually control the water pumps or, you know, run the SCADA system in the factory, the guys who administer this thing day to day, they're not technologists by trade. They are.
and you know what? It shouldn't have to be. That's where I put the onus on the vendors. I mean, the vendors have, we're going to do it this way. It's the same with IP cameras and stuff. You know, a lot of the traditional you know, security systems, physical security systems like cameras, they're putting them on the wire. They used to be DVRs, and now they're over IP networks. But they aren't taking any security issues into consideration. And, you know, a cop, that's not his job. You know, police force, they're not, you know, a university police force, for example, isn't thinking about the IT security ramifications of that. So they buy a product and then they...
Well, certainly not in America. They're buffing up their pressure pepper spray so they can spray people sitting down on the ground just in case they run away.
Yeah. I mean,
they're coming right for us.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's going to get up. My God, tag him, pepper him.
But you know what I'm saying? It's yeah. You know, it's not really so when and they've been talking about SCADA vulnerabilities at Black Hat conferences for at least 3 years. And at first, nobody really paid attention because everybody was still trying to figure out what a SCADA system was. and then finally, when they figured it out, they went, oh, cool. And now, you know, they're just not – when you know, and the guy, the hacker named Prof, who was interviewed by Sophos, said, you know, I'm doing this not to – you know, I'm doing this to prove a point. I want you guys to start paying attention. And then that sort of might lead into the Charlie Miller story, who got kicked out of the Apple development store. You know, how far do you have to go to make people pay attention? I mean, when is too much too much? I mean, yeah. This guy did a proof of concept and uploaded some malware, albeit secretly, to the Apple store to prove that he could bypass Apple's controls. And half the people were saying, well, he violated the terms of service. But, you know, when you deal with these companies like Siemens and Apple, I mean, their lack of responsiveness, it's frustrating to somebody in the security community because they're doing the right thing. They're telling you, you know, they're whistleblowing. When are you, I mean, the big information was that Apple let an iTunes vulnerability sit for 1,200 days before patching it.
Mm. Wow. I mean, the thing about it is that SCADA is starting to focus. So the companies like Siemens, whose real specialization is making light bulbs, will finally have to learn what a computer and a PABX actually looks like and get on with doing something about it.
Well, do you think the, like in infrastructure, city infrastructure, a lot of those things don't fall under the IT department? Like sometimes I don't even know they exist. And I'm wondering if maybe they need to change the boundaries of that. If something's being put on a network, shouldn't IT be paying attention to it?
Well, it's difficult. The people who run SCADA often have a hammer in one hand and a box of tools, and in the other hand they have a laptop that works the SCADA, so there's often a bridge. The second problem that you have is that as Mrs. Y says, is that the SCADA system can only be secured by the vendors, and the companies who've been making SCADA systems for the past 50 years, you know, or, you know, way back until the dinosaurs first started to push buttons, is that they've done really dumb decisions. They've worked in isolation. There's never been a security model. Physical security was the model. So now they're sitting in a situation where the people who make SCADA systems is like NEC and Siemens and, you know, massive multinational conglomerates who make factory robots, that type of stuff. And the electronics that straps on the side of it is just an afterthought. It's not a core business for them. So IT security isn't the purpose. So what it does mean is that companies like, and Siemens is the most egregious company at the moment, is that they just don't do any security on their SCADA systems because they just, it's not part of their core profile. And so it's up to the vendors to make the first move here and put, you know, simple things like Radius or TACAX engines and support for tokens into their login systems and, you know, have it so that you don't actually turn the screen on 24 hours a day so you don't lose the password. You know, you have to implement all those controls that we started to implement. Well, you know, even for desktops, we only started to implement some of this just a few years back.
I think it's going to take a big vulnerability. Like, they're going to have to be exposed for millions of dollars, not just hacking water pumps at some, you know, sewage treatment facility in Illinois somewhere. It's going to have to be.
But that Illinois hack was pretty bad. I mean, did you hear exactly what happened, how it failed? I mean, it was turned on and off repeatedly.
Well, I understand that, but in order to get Siemens to wake up and understand that security is not an afterthought, and I don't want this to happen, but I'm afraid it's going to go that far,
yeah.
I think somebody's going to have to die. Or there's going to have to be enough liability that Siemens looks, you know, the board members get together and say, hey, this isn't going to work if we don't put something in so that we don't look bad in the press.
Yeah, Siemens' core business is making power plants and light bulbs, and they also make some medical equipment and some PABXs and other bits and pieces as well, but it's not really what they do. So I guess talking about failures of various things, we had a bug recently in the Juniper router, or appears to have been a bug, where several of the major backbones in America went into a bit of a meltdown for a while, because somebody decided that sending BGP packets to a router would make it pop. Did anybody get affected by the outage? I did.
So fast. Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, it happened when I was trying to do some work on the website, and then I had definite problems getting to and from things. And then I noticed there was a bug with the internet, so I just went and did something else for a couple of hours. and figured that somebody would get on with it. If not, I would be getting Bibles and guns and heading for the hills.
I think it was mostly contained by about 6:30, 7 a.m. Central Time in the U.S. to the point where Level 3 had figured out what was causing the problem. And then it was just a matter of us figuring out what was causing the problem and trying to get behind the paywall at Juniper's website to figure out exactly what it was.
Well, I mean, for all that we're talking about Juniper here, the big thing about this one is that it was desperately visible. We probably shouldn't forget that it was only 3 or 4 weeks ago that BlackBerry had a major outage that they were fingering on a Cisco switch. Apparently there was an update done that didn't go too well. It's a phone. Hang on, I've got to answer this. Somebody take over.
It's a blast from the past.
Yeah.
Now, I think, because the first thing that everyone started talking about when the BGP update happened was that Cisco had a similar vulnerability last year with iOS XR accepting malformed BGP updates when Ripe decided to force feed them into certain switches. And while I agree that that did happen, that also blackholed, 1% of the internet for about half an hour until they got it sorted out. This was a persistent problem. And do you blame this on the vendor because they're writing code that can possibly be exploited? Or do you blame this on BGP for allowing something like that to happen without implementing some kind of authentication or checking of those attributes before they're passed along?
What exactly do we know? What exactly happened? What I know it was in BGP in the firmware, but what exactly happened?
I tried to get details on it, and you have to be a Juniper customer to download the advisory, and I'm not a Juniper customer, so I'm going on third-hand information at this point. I don't know if it was a buffer overflow exploit or if it was like Cisco's was last year with a malformed attribute value that caused the router to go into a hard stop. I know that the effect was that the router actually core dumped and then rebooted. And then when it got the update again from its neighbor, it core dumped again.
Well, this is somewhat similar to the bind issue that came out. Nobody's really talking about how you set it off. I've seen nothing on this, but what happened basically, it gets a malformed UDP packet and it has an assertion failure and it stops, the server fails and you can't recurse against it anymore. So anybody with recursive name servers around the internet was having problems. I was seeing postings to the bind list about, I'm getting this error, what do I do? And finally they came out with a patch. But nobody's really talking about, oh, was this an exploit in the wild? It just stopped. The same kind of situation.
I'm guessing it probably wasn't an exploit in the wild, and they were trying to keep it from being an exploit in the wild by not talking about it.
But how did it set off, though? Because people were talking, it was happening, and it never happened before. And all of a sudden, this assertion failure was occurring. So I'm thinking that somebody found something.
Well, somebody found something, or maybe there's a lot of stupid client software out there that maybe just inadvertently triggered it, maybe a software update or something like that, and maybe that was it. But yeah, I'm not quite sure how it was discovered either.
Yeah, it's the same kind of thing, though. It's I'm wondering, and usually ISC is really they freely share that stuff, but it seems like people are being less inclined. Vendors are being less inclined to share that. Like,
well, in the case of Juniper, this was actually a bug in 10.3 and 10.4 revisions of Junos, and it already had been patched. But the problem is the largest user of Junos is service providers. Right. And for better or for worse, a lot of service providers have networks that are built so that that switch cannot be taken down to be updated. It's like, you know, the uptime command on Linux.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, how long have you been up? Oh, so you've not been patched. That kind of thing. So a lot of people, you know, were quick to point out, oh, this has already been patched. But Juniper went ahead and released another hotfix to patch it further and reduce the visibility of the bug. And I guess it worked because other than this show, this is the first time I've heard about it in 2 or 3 weeks.
Hmm. So So how does level three have? How do they plan a maintenance window?
Exactly.
I mean, that's actually becoming a serious problem. You know, even at the university, I remember when you could just take something down. You know, you'd call somebody, or you wouldn't even tell them. You're just like, yeah, I'm you know, I knew one guy who used to stand in front of the monitor in front of the Windows servers in a place I worked a long time ago. And somebody would come in, is there something going on with the server network? And he'd say, no, I don't know what you're talking about. And he'd be standing in front of the monitor so they couldn't see. And, you know, I'm sure Bob remembers those days. And now it's like, you got to get a dispensation from the Pope to take something down.
Yeah, you'd swear that people's lives were in danger because we were wanting to patch the student data system or something like that on a Sunday morning at 6 a.m., you know?
Yeah, that students aren't even awake then. I mean, come
yeah, on. You know, they're all drunk and hungover, you know? Right. It's like, come on.
I guess now it's the time for a proper that's not how you design your network rant, right?
Oh, it's an Ivan rant. Call CNN.
the problem all these service providers have is that they bought two big boxes. As you know, if you remember how we designed networks like 15 years ago, when there was no enterprise and service provider stuff, you just took two boxes and you made them redundant so you could upgrade them and reload them and whatever. And then the telcos came on board and they said, we want to have one huge single box and it should have high redundancy and high availability and who knows what else. And no one was able to tell them, hey, that's not how you design data networks. That might be good for voice.
Nice.
Well, and even in voice networks, we know that that's not how you design them.
You're not? Really? No redundancy in voice? What?
You know what I'm saying.
Yeah. I do think we've run into that where, people have designed it such that even with two boxes, you can't do a reload or take it down to patch it. And they're telling you that they can't, but which is worse, not doing the update or, you know, being vulnerable to these exploits?
Amy, I've had a person tell me, I remember, it must have been 6 or 7 years ago when this kind of, shift started with maintenance windows. And I remember telling somebody, and Bob wanted to patch, there was a kernel patch for a Sunbox and it was a serious, vulnerability in the kernel. And I said, look, if I don't patch this, the box is going to crash. And the manager looked at me and said, you know what? Let it crash.
Yeah, I swear that half the time it just needs to die before you can, like, actually get anybody to commit to letting you do something, you know?
Yeah, it's like this idea of, you know, we'd rather do the paperwork for a crash than have to do the public relations to get the downtime.
Well, I think that's a corollary to what Tom was saying, too, about somebody's going to have to die with the SCADA stuff, you know, like, you know, sewage is going to have to be released into a river or something like that in order for people to pay attention to the vulnerability. It's the same thing with all these exploits, you know, in order for them to get any priority, somebody has to see that there's actually a problem and not just you making it up, you know?
Yeah, so can you blame security guys? They get so frustrated, and people find them to be aggressive sometimes, like Charlie Miller. You know, Apple just said, oh, we're kicking you out. It's like...
But he had to do that.
Yeah, if you don't... I've been in that situation, and you go through...
Yeah, but he was a bit... Yeah, come on. But the security people, 9 times out of 10, are so retarded, they need a good slap. They walk around acting like this. You know, sun shines out of their butt.
But to be fair, okay... Granted, there's a lot of...
This is coming out somewhere.
No, come on. Sure, I'm the first one to agree that there's a lot of arrogance in the security community. But on the other hand, a lot of them are really trying to do some good work, and they're really trying to notify the public, and they're trying to fix things, and there's a lot of resistance. And I had this conversation last week with somebody in the nonprofit community. How do you... There's a problem essentially beyond just the technical information, and it's about the neuroscience of changing somebody's mind. And I think that's where, as an industry, not just in security, but sometimes that's where we fail, is that we fail to recognize that the neuroscience of people seeing change as a threat, the middle brain.
Security people need to get down off their hobby horse and feel like they're being persecuted, right? That problem that you just described about not being listened to is universal. I get that as a network architect when I'm going up against a Windows administrator who says, we need budget for Windows 7 updates. And everybody nods wisely and goes, well, yeah, we definitely need Windows 7 updates. And I go, you do realize that if you shift to Windows 7, you're going to quadruple the effective bandwidth. And the peak bandwidth is going to take a hammering. Therefore, before you can upgrade to Windows 7, you need networking bandwidth. And they will look at you and go like, huh, what? They can't comprehend, you know, like you have to be a good communicator. You have to be effectively able to marshal your arguments and your debates. And 99% of security idiots can't actually have a grown-up discussion and a rational, coherent argument. All they do is go, blah, blah, fear, uncertainty, and doubt, blah, blah, blah.
But I don't think that's unique to just security people. I mean, I think, Bob, you can back me up on this. How many Absolutely. Rain men do you know in the Unix community?
Oh, yeah, sandaled Rain men, yeah, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there was a guy who I've
or
known.
Or networking.
Anywhere.
Yeah, the whole IT community is built on people who are not good communicators. Well, they're all introverts, you know, like, and the odd extrovert that comes along scares the crap out of them, you know, so.
And that's the problem in the industry, and I think that's where we need to step up. And, you know, emotional intelligence came out more than 10 years ago. And I think that's a valid skill for us in the IT industry. People make fun of it. Oh, we don't like to talk to people. We're so much smarter. But you know what? I did, you know, not to push a blog post, but, you know, these people aren't stupid. Their IT and the infrastructure we set up is just a tool to facilitate them to do what they need to do, you know, run police forces, universities, businesses. And until we recognize that and we're facilitating that and get off all of us collectively get off our high horses and, you know, help them get on with their lives. I mean, we're just, yeah. I think we're going
to
constantly.
I'm just tired of listening to security people say nobody's listening to us. And maybe they should finally realize that you're dead right. We're not listening to you because you don't make any sense. You babble instead of actually having a grown-up discussion.
I think that's true in a lot of cases. I agree with
yeah. That's a gross overgeneralization, and you can easily shoot me down on that. I mean, look at the Segoyan what is his name? Segoyan right. guy. Chris Segoyan, is that his name? Christian
yeah.
Segoyan?
Yeah.
He's going around doing amazing things by, you know, putting things into the light, taking things out of the darkness and releasing them into the public. And having a grown-up discussion, except for the hair. The hair is a bit of a problem, right?
Not Greg approved.
Well, come on.
The issue is one of risk. How much risk is acceptable? I think a lot of the security issues that come up, people look at them and go, we must react. We have to do something about this. We must patch. We must put new systems in place to overcome this. And the business looks at it and goes, well, what's the likelihood of this happening to us? What's the likelihood this vulnerability that's been discovered is going to hit us? And you look at it and go, well, really pretty small. It's possible, but A, we're probably not a target. And if we are, the damage would be minimal and so on. But we really should patch. We really should go and fix this thing. And the business says, no, screw it. I don't really care. It's just not worth a headache to us.
Rather than having a completely reactionary setups like this, you know, where like, oh, my God, the sky is falling all the time. You know, this is just an argument for businesses, IT shops having more regular maintenance windows, you know, every 3 months patches are applied anyhow, you know, things like that, where it's not a discussion anymore, you know. And if it's not high priority, it just gets taken care of at the next patch window, you know, that sort of thing.
I think that's great. And that's so true. I mean, we need to meet each other halfway. I think right now there seems to be this posturing that happens when people are in this aggressive state with each other. And it's not empowering both sides. And we need to recognize, you know, we need to really, and I'm going to say it again, that we need to emphasize emotional intelligence as a skill that is lacking in the IT community. And we need to find ways to communicate with each other that aren't about disempowering each other.
You know what's going to fix all of this, all this security stuff? Next-gen firewalls. The bright next-gen firewall fixes everything.
Well, apparently it doesn't. I mean, that's what the numbers state. It's just, it's a, you know, it's what? Just a big hot ball of hot air.
What were you eating today, Ethan?
I left the Vegemite on the shelf this morning. I did not have Vegemite with my toast, so we can't blame it on the Aussies. Not this time.
That's it. Lack of Vegemite.
No, I brought this up. There was an article on net-security.org regarding next-gen firewalls being essentially a failure. Next-gen firewall meaning we've rolled in inspections all the way up through layer 7 into this box, and so it's the one box that's going to do it all for you. It's going to be your access control, your VPN termination device. It's going to inspect all your traffic at a high level, and it's just going to make everything sane and clean that enters your network. And if it's not nice traffic, we're going to throw it away. And it doesn't seem to be working out real well. Yeah, well, right.
You're the one that came up with the next-gen fire, that they started promoting that whole next-gen firewall concept, and which I couldn't figure out how is the next-gen firewall really different than just an integrated IPS in a fire. You know, it's just IPS in a way. It's reboxed IPS. So then, you know, the emperor has no clothes, and that article came out and said, what was it? More than 62% of current next-gen firewall users surveyed suffer performance degradation. Duh.
I think you've just defined all security. For any security action, 90-100% of all users suffer performance loss. Why whine about just one particular aspect of it?
I guess the problem was it was promoted as it was going to save security, it was going to save the world, make everybody's lives easier, you know,
and they said that about IDSs and they didn't work, and they said that about IPSs and they didn't work, and then they said that about security policy documents and that didn't work, and then they said that about next generation firewalls and that didn't work, and now they're talking about advanced persistent threat technologies, and guess what, they ain't going to work either. Until security industry wakes up and shakes. There's a really good article this week about from a guy called Dan Gear, and he talks about the cybersecurity research agenda. There's only six things that need to do. One is we don't need to research anything. We just need to put in practice what we already know. In other words, security is if we just patched everything and did all the things that we know about security, we probably wouldn't have any security to research. Ta-da! Add firewalls, block outbound access.
Well, you know, I would argue with that to some degree based on there was a paper that came out about intelligence-driven computer network defense, and they're looking at it in terms of a kill chain, like the old defense, physical defense kill chains. And they're saying that until we get more intelligent systems that seem to inform each other, we're not going to see the patterns. And, you know, one small intrusional fail, we'll see something dropped at the firewall, but we won't see it as part of a bigger chain. And then we won't understand the advanced persistent threat, the data that might be exfiltrated out. I mean, I think that's valid to some degree, but I also think that it's failing to connect all the dots is going to be we're going to get increasing numbers of compromises very similar to RSA.
True. So speaking of nothing about security, this week our good friend Ivan Pepelniak, who happens to be on the show, announced that he is renaming his blog. Tell us a little bit about that, Ivan. That's a big – your blog iOS Hints has been around for years and years and years, so changing the name must have been a big decision. Yeah, 5 years.
Yeah, it was. It was simmering for like 6 months or so. As you know, I really started with small articles about how to configure individual features on Cisco iOS, and that's what brought me to blogging in the first place. And then over the years, the focus shifted to all different things, and Cisco is right now probably like 20% of the content. Well, even there, you know, it's Cisco and Juniper and Brocade and Arista and Forestan and OpenFlow and who knows what else.
Yeah,
the name and the content were more and more out of alignment. So I said, well, you know, it's time to start working on something new. I was thinking about this for probably a year. And then sometime in the spring, my wife said, well, you know what, I'll design you a new logo. And she did that on a piece of paper. And I carefully archived that for a few months and finally sent it over to a designer saying, hey, guy, you're doing such great things for my web and blog and everything. Could you please take this logo and, you know, polish it a bit? And he did a great job and sent me back like 50 different ideas to choose from. which was a total overkill.
It's funny
course.
When they do that.
yeah, and in the end, we settled on the original one I sent him. And then that logo was sitting in my inbox for a few months. What really tripped me over was the networking field day. Abner gave us access to Junosphere and said, okay, if I start writing about Junos on top of iOS, well, then I have to change the name.
Mm.
So that was like the last straw, sort of.
Well, it's a big change. I mean, it's a big thing to rename your blog, especially something that's, you know, pretty well known and pretty well think out there. So well done for that. And changing as the industry changes too, because I think that's fascinating that, you know, if you think 5 years ago, the only technology you would have worked on would have been iOS and Cisco. And today,
exactly,
we are working about a wider range of products and vendors.
Actually, personally, I have to thank you and Stephen Foskett for the shift. Because if you guys wouldn't pull me over for the networking field day last year, this thing wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, but it's been kind of fun. So, Ethan, you were talking about something there.
Well, hey, I, of course, we all read each other's blogs. And, Greg, I spotted on your blog this article this week about HP changing their licensing structure pretty dramatically. What was that all about?
Well, yeah, HP posted a blog post this week saying that they are going to have just one software license for every wired switch. So all of their Ethernet products, from right the way from top to bottom, from S to E to V to A, which is their four different product lines, will all have one software license and at the time you buy it. So there'll be no activation licenses, no this license advance. It's just one license across the whole suite. And as anybody who's bought licensed software for Cisco iOS knows, there's just no that is joyous. Joyous news.
I was going to say, it's the best news ever. I mean, it's just, I don't know if any of you guys have had to do with Cisco voice licensing. I'm sure Tom has. But yeah, it's just when someone announces a simplified licensing structure, I think everyone should get up and rejoice, you know, do a little dance. It's awesome.
Okay. I know it's great news from the operational perspective. And I don't want to be Cisco's advocate here. But think about another problem. They still have to get the money in to do their R&D.
Yeah, I'm wondering how much of it isn't just a technique. I mean, I don't know if you saw that lawsuit that came out today that HP actually tried to sue a former employee and prevent them from taking a job at Cisco. And so I don't know how much of this this licensing model is just a way to sort of undercut. You know, it's not a way, oh, yes, we love – you know, administrators, we want to make their lives easier, or is it just a marketing ploy to try to eat away at some business?
Of course, it's a money play for sure. HP has made it no secret that they're going after Cisco hard, furiously. I think I've made this comment on the podcast before that when HP sales folks have come to my place of business to talk to me about HP switching, Cisco has been referred to as the enemy. So, I mean, it's baked right into their culture. It's not a subtle thing. They do a move like this, what they're really saying, HP is saying, hey, we know people hate Cisco licensing, and don't even get me started on SmartNet and support and all that, because I blogged about that plenty this week. If they can make a play and say, we're going to make your licensing much easier to deal with, it's going to be a much easier thing, they may win some business out of that. They're already picking up percentage points on Cisco, and I think this is just another way they can go down that road and try to eat away at Cisco's market share and try to establish themselves better. They're still struggling with identity. They're still challenged with the huge number of products that they have out there. So anything they can do to get people's attention, get them to look back at HP and consider them again, they're going to do that. And I think that's the real motivation behind this thing.
Yeah,
so it's not at the goodness of their hearts. It's more...
Ethan... The problem is, as we are always telling our customers when they start negotiating the pricing of our assistance service, we need some margin. If you think we can live without margin, then eventually we will have no money to invest. So
but the
everything
problem
will
I
fall
have
apart.
With licensing, the challenge I have with licensing programs today is the cost of administering them. So the cost that it takes to buy a Cisco, identify the right license, and spend 20 or 30 hours reading through the cryptic documentation that says what feature is in what version of code, of version of license, then buying that license, and then putting that product, that hardware product, and the base license and the advanced license into Cisco's maintenance platform or Juniper's or whoever's is so hard and so costly that I worked for a company, a year ago, 18 months ago, and they had 10 engineers and they had two people working full time on Cisco maintenance contracts. That's how many hours
a day. And if you don't have those people to dedicate, I mean, I remember it took me probably 3 months to fix our Checkpoint licensing and to find out that we were overpaying. And I'm betting that a lot of these companies depend on this. They make this process so Byzantine that they know people are overpaying for licenses. We were overpaying by, I think, $100,000. And for licenses we weren't even using anymore. And so how common is this? And so that's just it's like a slush fund it becomes.
Yeah. Well, nobody's complaining about it. Everybody tells their sales rep, but the sales rep doesn't care. It's not his problem to solve. So, unless everybody starts logging bugs with Cisco TAC saying that your licensing system is a fail, because the only part of Cisco that listens back is the TAC. And you can log bugs for anything. You can log a bug that for the fact that Cisco iOS licensing is failing, and it will get listened to, funnily enough.
Well, let me tell you this. This is actually old news to me, because 8 months ago at HP, Jay Melman told me that on HP's A-series switches, there was never going to be a license charge, because that's the way they came from Huawei 3Com, was they were always licensed top to bottom for everything you could do in a box. This was new to me then because I was used to working with the ProCurve or E-Series stuff. Well, 3 months ago, they eliminated A-Series, E-Series. They're all one big product line. Well, now they announce, well, we're not going to charge you individually for a license to go on an E-Series. We're just going to give it to you. Well, actually, what we're going to do is we're going to raise the price of the switch, the cost of the license, so that we can recover that cost anyway. If you want to impress me, HP, give me a free license for all the ProCurve equipment that I have out in the field right now that won't do multicast routing or OSPF, because that was considered to be a luxury that you didn't need at the time. I think that this is them noticing there was a pain point and saying, you know what? We need something to go to market with. So if you really want to win my business back, make sure that all that stuff that you sold me with a lifetime warranty is still going to be taken care of by this policy, because I promise you, it's not.
I wonder how much money it's costing Cisco to set up this licensing scheme and administer it. How much money do they actually pour into making licensing and servers and software that does licensing compliance and the whole process of developing a product to sell?
It's not enough.
Not enough. I agree, Tom. Yeah. It's not enough. We're not doing it right is my point.
To give you an idea, when I was at Cisco Live this year, this was my first year of being a CCIE and a net vet, which means that I got to go to a special reception with John Chambers. And one of the rules is that you're allowed to ask him a no-holds-barred question, and he'll answer it for you. And I waited, and I bided my time, and I asked him a question about licensing. And when I got done asking my question, I got a round of applause from the entire room, because they were all sitting there nodding their head that, yes, licensing is quite possibly the dumbest thing you've ever come up with, and it's making our lives miserable, and we can't bill for that time. How are you going to put that down on a line item? It's like, oh, I spent 8 hours configuring your switch and 4 hours on the phone with tax sorting out the licensing. So I think that they're understanding at this point that licensing is starting to cost them money. Look at the change they made in iOS 15. Was it 15.1.4T? Now they're back to the honor system for licensing router iOS, because so many people were having a fit trying to find out that IPv6 link authentication is actually part of the security license, because it has to use an advanced encryption method that isn't available in the basic data license, that they're like, you know what? I'm just going to go buy a Juniper box because it just works there.
I was going to say, I don't think anybody objects to these companies making money. And we know that they have to make some sort of margin, do research and development. It's just, like you said, the implementation of this licensing is so insane. I don't even know how the salespeople sell it. I watched a ASA 101 licensing WebEx, and I was more confused at the end. I was like, I thought I understood this. Now maybe I don't.
And that's exactly what I was going to – that's the point I was going to make. You'll call and you'll say, well, does my license – what does my license include? Or does it include this and not this? Or how do I – because you just want to buy it at that point when you need it. But then you'll call and the support people don't even know, or your salesperson doesn't know, or your SE doesn't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, so if you're going to implement this really Byzantine, draconian licensing structure, then you better invest the time and money to really train everybody to understand what is what. And then don't change the names or the content of the license every 3 or 4 months to confuse us even worse.
Yeah. You can end up like the Microsoft reseller industry, and they have special consulting teams, specially trained consultants. And these are highly paid, 6 figures, 7 figures. Consultants whose job it is to understand Microsoft licensing. That's all they do. That's their whole
story. Microsoft licensing.
I think so, people get to the point where it's so complicated, like you said, they throw up their hands and they go somewhere else.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I would suggest that we're at that point now. It's just one of the many. You know, it's part of an overall thing. But licensing, we all hate it, and I'm sure a lot of people inside Cisco do too. But we're just talking about it. What else should we talk about, guys?
Well, do we want to talk about anything fun? Is there anything lighthearted people are buying for the holidays or anything like that, as opposed to all this hard and heavy security and licensing?
That's a good topic for Thanksgiving, yeah? Security and licensing.
It kind of goes with what we're buying for Christmas, yeah.
Actually, most people out there are giving thanks. They don't have to work with security or licensing on a regular basis.
Yeah. Exactly. I have a philosophical question regarding the iPad for you guys that have iPads, and I think there's a few of you on the call that do. Now that you've had it for a while, do you still love it? Do you still use it? Has the shine worn off? Do I still want one? Because I haven't bought one yet.
Yes, yes, no, and yes.
I used it and went, but I can't type fast on this. Bob, are you – I mean, if you're a touch typist, it's that virtual keyboard, I just –
The virtual keyboard is horrible, but I really love it. It's horrible. If I'm gonna blog, if I'm gonna do any sort of serious writing or whatever, I find a real computer with a real keyboard. But my laptop use is way down. The iPad is where it's at right now, and my wife loves her iPad. Yeah, it's. Yeah, in fact, I had to get another iPad so she would stop using mine. It was reminiscent of me growing up with my brother fighting over who got to use the computer. You know, like the shine is still there. Apple keeps making significant improvements to the software that's backwards compatible. So you know, your iPad 1 can still run iOS 5 and things like that. That'll probably eventually change.
But here's the real question: how many times have you dropped it?
Zero times, though I did take it out on the deer stand this last weekend and was reading a book on it. The battery, turns out when the battery gets really cold, it does some funky things, and then I almost dropped it in my excitement that I actually saw a deer. So,
my kids dropped it.
Your kids dropped
it? My kids dropped it like 3 times.
So, did it survive?
Yeah, no problem.
Cool.
Yeah, I've dropped mine several times. I find I've had my iPad for 2 years now, so I was one of the lucky people who bought one just after Apple released them. I happened to be in Boston long before they were released and picked one up at the Apple store. And although I still use it for reading, I've started reading more iBooks on there, and I've got some really neat apps, Goodreader, which allows me to read PDFs. It's a great way of reading PDFs.
Yes.
And stuff like that. But in terms of reading the web and doing useful things like capturing data and saving it, writing anything, it's not very good. So for niche stuff, my gut feeling is that next year, I'm fingers crossed, hoping that Apple will release a new MacBook Pro, which will look like a MacBook Air. So it'll be really, really thin, but with all the big CPU and the big memory. And if they release that, then I probably won't bother buying another iPad. I'll probably give it away and use it.
The rumor is a 15-inch MacBook Air. That's what all the fanboys are saying is coming out.
Hey, did you have to tell me this? I just bought mine. Yeah. Thank you.
Isn't that always how it is, though?
No. Ivan, the point to owning Mac is that once you enter that hallowed hall of fanboydom, you have to then pay attention to all the lists of the cycles of when new things come out, and you plan your purchase based on those cycles and rumors. It's part of the...
Well, I wouldn't. I mean, the answer is you start today, and, you know, in a year's time or 2 years' time, you'll be ready to buy another one, and there'll be something greater and more wonderful. Then I try and buy my MacBooks, and they'll last me 3 years before I'll cycle them out. I don't – it's not like Windows where they stop having enough horsepower or enough hard drive space after 6 months because the operating system builds up cruft or, you know, the memory footprint gets bigger or something like that. I don't have that problem on the Mac. 2 years – you can certainly get 2 years out of a MacBook. Before
get more. I upgraded the firmware on the unibody Mac, and I was able to put 8 gig of RAM and a terabyte hard drive and it works great.
Okay.
By the way, coming back to Ethan's question, iPad is the reading device. So whatever reading you do, iPad is perfect form factor, perfect weight, good screen. So PDFs, email till you want to start replying, Twitter stream, it's perfect for that. For any
PDFs
typing
was
beyond three characters.
Yeah, PDFs was the big thing that I had in mind. I have a lot of PDFs that I need to read and never seem to get around to it on the laptop because on the laptop I'm always doing other things other than sitting and reading a PDF. So
yeah.
I thought the iPad
Ethan,
would be a
I
good
stopped
fit
printing.
There.
I stopped printing when I got iPad.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true.
While we were out of Network Field Day, they started releasing Cisco started releasing documentation into ebook form, so that it can be imported directly into iBooks. You don't even need to use the PDFs anymore.
No, PDF is a good format.
Yeah, I like it, but I think that they're starting to see that more people are using iDevices or tablets to do their documentation updates, you know, because you can just grab the tablet or, you know, toss it at your junior admin and go, hey, you need to go fix this Nexus. Here's the documentation, as opposed to sending them a URL or sending them with 1,000 pages of whatever.
Which is probably a good point to talk about our show sponsor for this week, one of our show sponsors, from Get Console. So forget using SSH or other generic iPad terminal apps. Get Console was designed and developed by CCIE specifically for network engineers to speed up their comms room work. Get Console is the best Apple-approved app for iPad serial connectivity. Apart from Telnet and SSH, Get Console allows you to connect your iPad to network gear using a serial console cable, meaning that comms room tasks that used to require lugging a laptop all the way down to where the equipment was and plugging in the console cable can now be done with an iPad or even an iPhone with this app. With Get Console, you can combine field engineer skills with those of senior staff in the NOC by enabling full remote control of your iPad's terminal window for instant collaboration and specialist assistance. With Get Console, you can turn your iPhone into an instant out-of-band modem for the Cisco TAC and or other specialists who get into networking gear even when the WAN is down. Get Console has many more features, including full logging, config downloads, tight cuts, and paste integration, and at only $10 on the Apple Store is a worthy addition to your engineering toolkit. Check out www.getconsole.co.uk, and to receive a 10% discount on an iPad serial cable, use the discount code PacketPushers at the checkout. We'd like to thank Get Console for sponsoring the Packet Pushers.
I could give a testimonial if you want. I actually
have
one.
You go on. Yeah, go right ahead.
I own a Get Console cable, and I have it with my iPod, or my iPad and my iPhone, and I actually use it now more for rack-to-rack troubleshooting and configuration than I do for lugging a laptop around, because it's so easy to have that configuration in a folder like a Dropbox, and I can just copy and paste it out of Dropbox into my iPad, into the Switch when I have to have console access to it. And that way I don't have to worry about, do I need to plug in? Do I have the right adapter? It all just works. And the capability that you have with giving it to a junior admin and saying, hey, I need to stay here where I can have full connectivity. You take this down the hall to the Switch, plug it in, type in this code, and then call me back with the code. I can get in remotely, and I don't have to worry about there being a network down situation or something like that. I have access to the 3G radio on that device. It's wonderful.
Cool. That's harnessing your GIMP, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It's getting him to go to work for you.
So we had a couple questions come in from Twitter. I tweeted out when we started recording if anybody has any questions. One of them is, big centralized wireless controllers, smaller controllers and branches, or a mix, and does wireless voice over IP change the answer? What do you guys think?
Yeah.
It depends.
Classic. Awesome.
Yeah, that's a lot. That could be a whole show, couldn't it?
That could be. I mean, I think the idea of we're coming up actually on a wireless tech field day in January. I'm not sure if I'm going yet, but I went through this discussion last year when I participated there. I think big centralized wireless controllers have shown that they're architecturally flawed in that the current designs for those controllers is that all traffic from the edge access points funnels back to the controller. And that means that all that encrypted traffic, all that volume, all that inspection comes back to a single choke point. And that's and all the state and everything is held in that central controller device. And that's a weakness for wireless controllers at this point in time. And so then the wireless industry is moving back to fat APs. That is, the access points have autonomous systems. They have their own control planes that do various things. And the wireless controller just becomes a central configuration engine, which is more sustainable for wireless networking. Smaller controllers in the branches or a mix. Aerohive, who recently sponsored the podcast, disclosure, have a system where they use a coherent model of control planes where they actually distribute configuration information around so that all networking devices have all the configuration info. They don't use any wireless controller, but they do have a central configuration element, usually based in the cloud or on a VM somewhere in your network. I don't think centralized wireless controllers or controllers matters much, except in terms of reliability. Getting to and from your controller is as reliable as the connectivity. So wireless controllers can work well inside of a building where you have copper from the access point to the switch and then a fiber optic between the switching and the, you know, the, that backplane. But where you start having problems with wireless is where you use Wi-Fi backhauling. So you have an access point chaining to a access point, chaining to an access point back to your controller. And that medium in the middle, it can be unreliable. And when configuration between the two is lost, your wireless network becomes inherently unreliable. So I think you need to look carefully at your technologies to make sure they match your technology. You need a wireless expert, somebody who understands it. It's a very specialized business. Does wireless VoIP change the answer? No, you can run wireless VoIP on anything insofar as IP telephony ever works.
Greg, there is an interesting problem there.
Sure.
Namely, if you have the centralized controller and if the traffic has to go through it, then you have the latency issue for the branches. And the other problem is if people within the branch communicate to each other, the whole thing goes up to the controller and back down, which is twice the bandwidth plus twice the latency.
Yep.
That's bad for data. It's totally unacceptable for voice.
You've got to have your quality of service right for wireless VoIP.
And that happens to two layers, too. That happens not just to the IP layer, but the wireless QoS happens at two layers. One is at the physical layer, so actually how you get access to the spectrum and how you transmit the radio signal. And it also happens at the IP layer where it runs over the top. That's something a lot of people don't actually understand.
Yeah, and if you have the controller in the central location and you have like 20 millisecond latency between the branch and the central location, then the two users on wireless phones in that same branch have 40 millisecond latency. Which is bad.
Yeah. So the answer to that question is exactly right as Ivan got it. It depends.
You really have to ask yourself, where does the traffic flow? Does it go through the controller, in which case you probably want to have it in the branches? Or is the controller just the control plane or just the management plane, in which case it doesn't matter?
Yeah, and then we had another question come in from Twitter, which is real simple, best practices for documentation. And I'll take a stab at this one right out of the gate because best practices for documentation, number one, have some. That would be the number one thing I would say right away. You got to have some diagrams for your network that clearly delineate each of your network environments and how they all interconnect. You need to be able to, at a glance, know what all of your IP blocks are, what your VLANs are, major route points, what your routing topology looks like. These are things that you can lay out in Visio or OmniGraffle. I don't care if you use stick figures. As long as there's something on there on a piece of paper you can look at, share with someone else and say, this is what the network looks like. Let's refer to this. That's one thing. Beyond those fundamentals, whatever you would categorize beyond what I said as a foundational document, you need to determine what, for me, I document things that are, I guess I would categorize them as weird. There are all kinds of unusual solutions that come in because of unique requirements of an application or a particular security paradigm that's in place to make a certain application work a certain way. And if you're not going to remember in 6 months how you made it all happen because it's different and it's unusual and not the normal way you do things, you got to document it. And those are the things beyond that foundational stuff that I tend to document. I've got, I've done blogs over time. I've done wikis over time. I do a lot in SharePoint these days where I will define what this thing is that we did and who the people were involved, what the equipment is, and how the, particularly outline how the traffic flows from authentication right through application and then, you know, getting it all closed out, and then failover and resiliency if that's a component of it, so that I remember just how this application works, because someday it's not going to work right and you're going to not remember what the heck was supposed to be happening and you're going to want something to go back to so that you remind yourself.
But don't you find the failure of most documentation to be not so much in whether or not it's documented, but that the documentation isn't all in the same place? I mean, that's one of the things I've seen. You know, this group's documentation is here, or this guy doesn't like the documentation system, so he puts it on his own. You know, this guy has a wiki. Then there's Documentum for this. And there, it's like in 10 different places, so you don't know where to look for the documentation. Or another problem is you have some in-house code, and maybe there's documentation on the system that runs the in-house proprietary code, but the code itself isn't documented, even it within the body of the code. Or, you know, another problem I've seen is there's just by standardizing the way that you do things, you can kind of self-document by naming your VLANs clearly. You know, instead of naming it colors or after names of alcohol, maybe you could. I mean, yeah, you get into a security issue of, oh, security through obscurity. But then, you know, does it have to be, are you really protecting anything through that? And can you find a middle ground that also enables it? You know, if you're going to have, you know, something dual homed, can you please plug it into the same port on both, you know, on those switches? You know, so you're not going, oh, I wonder which port it's plugged to on the other side. So,
no, I would agree strongly with what you just said about self-documenting. When building a switch or a firewall, you need to have a standard way that you name access lists, a standard way that you describe ports. Those sorts of things go an awful long way to being able to look at a configuration and intuitively right. understand what's going on. Yeah, I completely agree with that.
Well, Ethan, I tell all my junior admins to leave themselves clues all over the place. You know, the more breadcrumbs all over, that you leave, the more clues you have, such as standards, everything you guys have just been talking about. You know, the more chance you'll have at being able to look at a device without having to refer to the documentation. You know, because you can actually make a valid assumption that, you know, things are set up correctly. You
right.
know, and whether that's... it's cable, even cable colors, you know, like you can do stuff like that, you know. Well, and what Mrs. Y was saying about documentation location too, one of the best things my organization ever did was just decide we were going to use our wiki. We've got an Atlassian Confluence wiki, and it just became the de facto. Well, became the place that we put all documentation, and it's been really cool because it's always just there. It's searchable. If somebody wants to go in, there are some permissions, but the whole point of a wiki is that, you know, somebody can go in there. If they see something wrong, just fix it, you know? So.
Yeah, I mean, the problem I think arises from IT is not a democracy. When it works, it's a benevolent dictatorship. And at some point you have to say, you know, you will document, it will be located here. This is the extent. These are the standards that we will maintain for how you do things. I mean, it's interesting. I remember working with a junior who said, yeah, we plugged it into this port and this port. I said, wait a second. You That is not how we do things. You plug it into the same port on each switch when you multi-home. You don't vary from that. Well, what if so-and-so says it's okay? No, no, no. That's not okay. This is how we do it.
Yeah, they're wrong too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to weigh in on the wiki. I think a wiki is way better than SharePoint. SharePoint is all fine and good for people who can only conceive of doing documentation in Microsoft Word, but it's the worst possible form of documentation. The advantage of a wiki is that you can search it by keyword, and it'll take you to the page that's full of those keywords. So if you're looking for a document that's about a given device, you know, you've got a router that's called Beretta 01, well, you search on Beretta 01, and it'll show you all the bits where that's actually mentioned. You can do that in SharePoint, but then you end up in a Word document, and then you have to search inside of a Word document. And a Word document is the worst possible way to write in, because you spend 30 or 40% of your time tarting up the fonts and making sure the graphics are lined up in the middle. Nobody cares, right? You just want to get the content in and be done with it.
Yeah, but as you ride the unicorn into the server room where you can just put up a wiki or whatever it is you want, that's great. And I don't disagree with that.
Crying too.
I understand what you're saying about the fonts and the format, but I'll defend SharePoint in the context that a lot of businesses have embraced it. And therefore, if that's the tool you're given to use it, that's what you use. And if you spend time with SharePoint, you can make it better than what Microsoft gives you out of the box. There's a lot of customization you can do with it that makes it suck less.
I doubt it. So some more practical advice. When you're doing Visio diagrams or OmniGraph or diagrams, do not download the Visio shape sheets. They're a waste of time. Having a little round circle or a picture of what the router is a waste of time. The only thing that matters is the cable that connects to it and whether there's some text there that tells you something. So if you just get a square box, right, and then join the cable to it, then you're done. That's all you need. And if you want to differentiate a router and a firewall, then make them red for firewalls and a greeny, bluey color for routers. And then, you know, for dumb switches, have them as a bluey, greeny color maybe. But that's all you need. You don't need anything else, right? Forget about state shape sheets or style sheets or any of that. That's all your diagram needs. And when it comes to writing down documentation, here's my pet hate. It's not an English essay. You're not at high school, right? You're not about to hand in a creative writing episode to your teacher who you're all goo-goo-eyed about and who's going to mark you in marks out of 10, right? No paragraphs. All there should be in it is bullet points, tables, and diagrams. That's it. And most importantly, no adjectives. Nothing's lovely. Nothing's spectacularly great. Nothing's awesome. Everything is what it is. And if people aren't intelligent enough to read it, you don't explain anything in a document, in an operational document. All you say is the IP address is this, the interface is that, the code version of this, the testing done was that, the cables run from rack 5 to rack 10. You don't explain why unless it's really important. You just document. It's not an English writing exercise.
It's Greg, the key to keep it simple. People aren't going to do it if it's complicated. And if it's an afterthought, it needs to be a priority and it just needs to be simple, exactly like you're saying.
Yep.
If I could add two things to what you just said there. One is also when people are storing their documentation, storing their Visio, please put the original editable Visio document, not a PDF, not any of that stuff, in your documentation system. That's like one of my pet peeves is I find a PDF and I need to change something. You know, the other thing is your comment about colors. People need to be careful. There's a lot of color blindness out there, and red green is a popular one. And so the labels are always something that I stress when people are doing documentation, because labels and shapes, because colors themselves. And somebody who's red green color blind, if you've got a red firewall and a green router right next to each other, they may not be able to tell the difference.
Well, I agree with Greg. I mean, I've gotten such complicated Visio diagrams, you know, where they utilize like the pop-ups and the dimensions and everything else, and you can't figure out what connects where or what the flow is. It's like, can you just stop being in love with the complexity of Visio and just tell me how this is connected together?
Yeah, it's all you need to do. Just write it down. Just say what it is. If it's a big stinking pile, then it's a big stinking pile with tables and bullet points.
Stinking is an adjective, Greg.
I was just thinking that, Tom. Stinking is an adjective.
Well, the original term was a noun and was accurate. but not suitable for grown up use on a non explicit podcast. So let's just quickly go around the table as we get to the end phase of this virtual work whiteboard. Is there anything that anybody's thankful for at this particular point in time? Seeing as it is Americans Thanksgiving, let us that are offshore consider the sensibilities of you guys and say, what are you thankful for in this week of Thanksgiving? Let's start with Amy.
Oh, well, you know, I'm thankful that people continue to want Dial Tone, and I'll continue to give it to them.
Good luck to you. Tom.
I am thankful that users continue to decide that computers should just work and they don't need to learn about them, because as long as they want to do that, I will still have to figure out how to make them work, and I will continue to be gainfully employed in the IT industry until I decide I want to not be employed anymore.
Hoo-yah. What about you, Ivan? What are you thankful for this week?
Well, to have a group of friends like you guys to get together to chat about these stupidities when we should be doing something else. Isn't it great that we have time to do this?
It's not a bad life, is it, at all?
No.
It's not a bad life at all. Mrs. Y, what about you? What are you thankful for?
I'm thankful that people let me sit in the same room with them virtually or literally, who are way smarter than me and care about what I think. I learn so much every time I'm on the show or, you know, I spend time with other professionals, and that's what I'm thankful for.
Mr. Banks, what about you? What's making your buttons go red this week?
I'm thankful to our listeners and the people that subscribe, which sounds maybe contrived or a canned response, but Packet Pushers has done really well this year, and those folks that pay attention to us for whatever your insane reasons are, we are thankful for that. Thanks very much.
Yeah, and I want to second what Ethan said. Packet Pushers has it's come from being something that we did as a bit of a lark, really, when we started, what, a year and a half ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And we're now working with vendors. We have conferences to go to. We're always looking for more content. And the response that we've had from the audience in helping us and giving us hints and joining in the discussion has been great. And it's been really great to see the networking industry open up and have a discussion. We've got some interesting things happening next year, too. So we're having some... we're going to have more webinars and more resources. And I also want to thank the audience for being patient with us while we get the sponsorships off the ground and change from being what we were to where we're going to, because it's been it's really giving us the space. Like, we can now invest time in the show to do more stuff, and hopefully we're getting it right. And I've said it before and I'll say it again, if we're spending too much time being off topic, then write into us and we will be listening to what you say. So I'm thankful for those things and thankful for the opportunities that working in this pretty good industry. I mean, what sort of an industry lets you sit in a perfectly comfortable chair with, you know, it's clean, there's a toilet just down the corridor, and you get free coffee and they pay you to do that? I think that's awesome.
It is.
There's not too many things. So on that note, I'd like to thank everybody for listening to Packet Pushers, and we should be back again during the week next week. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for joining in, and we'll look forward to having another show in about 2 weeks' time. And remember that Packet Pushers is a Unicorn Tears production. And remember, too much networking would never be enough. Thanks for coming, everybody, and I'll speak to you all in the next week or two.
Hey, see everybody later.
All right.
Cheers all. Have a good Thanksgiving, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.